I am Ron Burke, Lutheran campus pastor at Southwest Texas State University, San Marcos, Texas, and the session is a campus pastor looks at sex and alcohol. You've all heard the story of how it got fouled up on the bulletin board somehow, and I turned it in very plain, but on the bulletin board it ended up a campus pastor works at sex and alcohol. I do that, but I don't want anybody to know about it. That kind of reminded me of an item that supposedly showed up in a church council minutes one time that read like this: the Board of Trustees reported that a peephole has been found bored into the wall of the women's restroom. The pastor said he would look into it. So that's not really what I had in mind, but I guess to start with, I should say a little bit about myself. This fall, 30 years ago, I set foot on the campus of Texas Lutheran College as an innocent young freshman, and I've never left the college campus since then. Someday I'm going to graduate. All that time I've been on a campus either as a student or as a pastor to a university community. I was a student of Texas Lutheran then in Columbus, Ohio, at whatever that seminary's name is now. They keep changing it so much, but it was Capital when I was there. Now it's Trinity, I think, and it's gone through some other ones. But anyway, and then I did graduate work at Ohio State University. And then I started out in the ministry in a town gown parish in Portales, New Mexico, where Eastern New Mexico University is. Did a lot of ministry there. Then I went to College Station, Texas, and I was a chaplain at Texas A&M University for 7 years. And the last 11 years, I have been the campus pastor at Southwest Texas State University in San Marcos, Texas. For those of you who don't know, that's LBJ's alma mater. So I'd throw that in there. And I guess the one thing that brought this about, and Charlie alluded to that in the the introductions, was that in probably those whole 30 years of my contact with the campus, the question that people who are concerned about students have, and the problem that students have, usually is always twofold, and that is concerned with the issue of sex and or alcohol. Those seem to be the two perennial topics of concern, interest, whatever you want to call it, for people who are concerned about the campus. And so I just thought tonight I would share some things, and maybe we could have a little lively discussion on those two things. What I'd like to do is just do some rather unconnected kinds of what I call random thoughts about each of these subjects. I'll start out with one, alcohol. We'll go alphabetically, and it shouldn't take me very long to share what I have to share, and then I'd just like to open it up for whatever reactions that you have or so forth, and we'll go about 25 minutes, and after we've had enough alcohol, we'll go on to sex. I don't think I said that right, but anyway. There's an old story about the minister of a local church who was walking down the street one day when he recognized the town drunk, unsteadily ambling along, and the minister looked at him very scornfully and said, "Drunk again." "Me too," said the drunk. It has really been fun for me to reread the Bible in some of the new translations, especially Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. I have just found some jewels over in those. And if you have not read Proverbs 23, 29, 35, and the Good News or the Today's English Version, this is what it says. "Show me someone who drinks too much, who has to try out fancy drinks, and I will show you someone miserable and sorry for himself, always causing trouble and always complaining. His eyes are bloodshot and he has bruises that could have been avoided. Don't let wine tempt you, even though it is rich red and you can see yourself in the cup and it looks so good as you swish it around. The next morning you will feel as if you have been bitten by a poisonous snake. Weird sights will appear before your eyes, and you will not be able to think or speak clearly. You will feel as if you were out on the ocean, seasick, swinging high up in the rigging of a tossing ship. I must have been hit, you will say. I must have been beaten up, but I don't remember it. Why can't I wake up? I need another drink. That's biblical wisdom for you. Another thought on alcohol, Frederick Buechner. If you're not familiar with him, you should be. He really has some good provocative thoughts, and this is one of his about communion wine. Wine is booze, which means it is dangerous and drunk-making. It makes the timid brave and the reserved amorous. It loosens the tongue and breaks the ice, especially when served in a loving cup. It kills germs. As symbols go, wine is a rather splendid one. And a quote by G.K. Chesterton, "No animal ever invented anything so bad as drunkenness, or so good as drink." And a little story that appeared in Reader's Digest some time ago. A campaigning politician was asked, "Are you for or against strong drink?" The politician replied, "If you mean, sir, the devil's brew that causes an untold number of auto accidents each year, which kill and maim thousands, that costs the American public billions through loss of work, that causes men to fight with their neighbors, wives to leave their husbands, men to lose their jobs, self-respect, and dignity, then I, sir, am strongly against it." Getting no response, he continued, "But if you mean the bottled spirits that give men temporary relief from the cares of the world, ease the aches and pains of the aged, bring men together in fellowship, provide work for thousands of farmers, distillers, bottlers, shippers, and storekeepers, the mellow brew that brings in billions in taxes and helps pay for defense, education, and many other good things in life, then I, sir, am for it." And finally, some thoughts from Ron Burke. I think that little story about the politician and alcohol fairly well catches my own mixed emotions about strong drink. To be quite honest, some of my most pleasant, most spiritual times have been over a glass of spirits. And at the same time, some of the most unpleasant, most miserable times in my life have been on those occasions when I had too many glasses. Some of my happiest times have been at cocktail parties and beer bust, while some of my saddest times have been spent administering to those injured in drink-related accidents, or worse yet, attempting to comfort the survivors of those killed in such accidents. Strong drink, as the politician said, is a paradox. And the Bible recognizes this. The psalmist lists wine to gladden the hearts of men in Psalm 104 as one of the gifts of God. But on the other hand, Paul includes drunkards among the list of those who will not inherit the kingdom of God in 1 Corinthians 6:10. I mention all this because I sense that many students, college students, are wrestling with this paradox of strong drink. The old line, "College is a fountain of knowledge where students come to drink," has never been truer than today. Alcohol is now legal on most campuses as the legal drinking age in most states has been lowered. On our particular campus, the fraternities, it seems like every week, sponsor a party, an all-campus party, and they headline it with 200 kegs. 200 kegs. Happy hour has almost become a required course on our campus, and I think on a lot of others. Now, for a lot of people, this is a good way to relax from the pressures of school, and as such can be regarded, I think, quite honestly, as a gift of God. Yet there are always those who overdo it, end up in a fight, or in a wreck, or in a strange bed. And it is these people who experience the, quote, evil side of drink and the consequences that go along with it. Quite frankly, nothing scares me more than the misuse, the abuse of alcohol among college students. But again, quite honestly, I really don't know what to do about it. Maybe the only thing to do is hope that some of those will be smart enough not to abuse alcohol, that some who abuse it will learn from their mistakes and never do it again, and that those who do abuse alcohol and don't learn have a good guardian angel. Well, there's some thoughts, rather varied, on alcohol and the campus. Does that trigger anything in you?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
I had not heard this before, that St. Paul said that a drunkard shall not inherit the kingdom of God. And I would presume then that you could infer from that anyone who is, as we call it these days, sick from being an alcoholic, has had it as far as the kingdom of God. And I just wonder whether St. Paul is, that's what he means, if that's what he means, and I'd say that he's probably wrong.
Anyone care to respond to that?
There is forgiveness.
Did that voice come from on high? Yes.
Well, I agree with you if that's what St. Paul said, that I don't agree with St. Paul. But I don't think that's what was meant. I think that taking a drink or being drunk is not an issue of salvation. But I think the sins that occur from unrepentant drinking, the unrepented sins that occur, such as child and wife abuse, relationship problems, some of the other things that you can talk about, are probably what St. Paul is after when he mentions that. So I would look at that as what St. Paul was talking about.
Of course, we all know that there are some alcoholics that never recover and die of being alcoholics, still being drunkards all the way till the time they're dead. And so even though we say that we don't judge what happens to other people, I don't know how you could infer in the other direction if that's what St. Paul said and that's what he meant.
Well, that's not the only one that's on that list. There are a lot of others.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We'll get into that in the next half of this discussion. But we've had some fun here the last, I can't remember when, but in my tenure here at Holden Village the last couple of weeks, on defining the kingdom of God. Was anybody in on that and know what the kingdom of God is?
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
Where's John Schramm when I need him? Is he really here? Give us a 25-word or less definition of the kingdom of God, John.
You just sat down.
Wherever God is king, wherever the Lord is the Lord. I just walked in. What? On sex and alcohol.
That's different then from everlasting life.
Okay, yeah, I think in the light of your question, and you know, that a drunkard shall not inherit the kingdom of God, we automatically think of that as eternal salvation or something, and I don't think that's what is inferred. I think it's probably that what, from just what John said, that means that probably the king of that person's life is alcohol, and their life is lived accordingly, with all of the consequences of what happens when you serve a king, and you get some negative consequences to that.
Very good.
Yeah, and the idea from whatever voice on high that you know, God is forgiving. I think that is the key. That's really what we're saying, that in the gospel, is that there is grace, and that any sin, alcohol among them, sin, we have to define sin later on, but, you know, that has consequences that God does not desire for us. And that is why Paul would come across so strong, I think, saying, hey, don't do this because you hurt yourself and other people. That's why the strong words. How about some other issues?
Schnuckenberg calls God's kingdom God's rule. In other words, God cannot rule that, you know, it's not in charge of that person's life.
Other questions? Let's don't get stuck on one area. Yes, sir?
Yeah, I wrestle with the question, the rhetorical question you threw out about how do we do something about that? What's the solution and the answer to that? And I try to look back and say, well, what's the cause? Why is that happening? And it seems to me that what you described, the beer bus and things like that, can be social release and fun. But we also know that college is a place of immense pressure and competition. It's a divorce from home and family life into a new environment with relationships that may be very competitive and not intimate and so forth. And so I'm wondering if there isn't a thread there of using alcohol or drugs as a substitute, creating a dependency, because of some of those kinds of things that are missing in the college environment, and maybe creating some more of that in the environment to help ease those kinds of burdens and problems will keep kids away, young folks away at least from that side of the alcohol situation.
The real problem, as I see it, trying to minister to it, is getting across to people that there is such a thing as alcohol use and alcohol abuse. I come from good anti-drinking country where there are a lot of people who, you know, alcohol use is alcohol abuse. And that's really tough to deal with because I happen not to be one of those. I was raised with that attitude and had lots of problems with that. But, you know, I think that history and religious history and everything else really clearly defines, the difference between alcohol use and abuse. The problem is, what's a fine line that separates them? And I think that's what most college students, you know, it's a learning experience in those age groups, and most of us went through that and learned by our mistakes. But that's a hard way to learn. Are there any, quote, college students here who would care to contribute to the conversation? Yes, sir.
I just graduated from Luther College in Corn, Iowa. Right there, right now they're having a big controversy about alcohol and its use on campus. In 1974, the alcohol policy, well, it used to be a dry campus. In 1974, the president of the college bought and got for the students the right to possess alcohol and keep it in their rooms. After that period of time, the ruling, it just kind of slowly evolved into something completely different. It went from being able to drink a few beers in your room to having a keg in your room. And pretty soon there were kegs in the halls, and pretty soon there were kegs in the showers. And every once in a while I got a keg out of the front lawn or something like that. And so 2 years ago, or last year, the president of the college, the same president who won that right for the students, put the kibosh on it. He said, no more kegs. And that caused a real uproar in the community. Well, it was triggered because the freshman girls' dorm, or the girls in the freshman dorm, were having kegs during the week. And they were starting to set hours for the kegs, and from 9 to 11 o'clock at night. And when he caught wind of that, that was it. No more kegs. So I guess the problem that I've found is the discrepancy in how, not necessarily, well, I don't know if the students can handle it, if that's the question, but how much freedom or how many rights or how much responsibility do you want to give students for that kind of thing? How much do you trust them? And how much can they be trusted to use it?
Sandy?
I personally feel that one of the main problems in our society, you're not allowed to drink till you're an adult. You get to college and you can drink. It's a sign of adulthood. It's, you know, if you can drink and handle your alcohol, that's really good. You're a good adult. You can handle it. You can drink more than anyone else. There are contests to see who can drink the most, who can handle it, who goes under the table first. It's a sign of adulthood. That's one of the problems, I think.
It's interesting that that's I won't say uniquely, but a uniquely American problem. That's not quite what I want to say. But anyway, in contrast to Europe, if any of you have traveled in Europe, in Germany especially, where many of us have our roots, there are no such age laws. I was there a couple of summers ago, and I was amazed. You'd go up to a Coke machine, there'd be a Coke, Sprite, and three or four different brands of beer, right out in public for anybody. I was in one hotel, and right outside my room was a little vending machine on the wall with these little bottles of liquor. You'd go out there, anybody wanted to put in there, had the money, you could get them out. America really has kind of fouled up the alcohol attitude, mainly because, as I understand it, there was alcohol abuse on the early frontier, and it was really a major problem. People overreacted, and just like a lot of administrators do, and that's kind of the history of alcohol. You have it, and everybody kind of agrees it's good, okay, but there's always some people that abuse it, gets out of hand, and people say the only way we can control it is prohibition, or something like that. And then that happens, and people react the other way against that.
Right, and that's exactly what's happening at Luther right now. There are a lot of people who are saying, well, if the kids can't handle the policy, then we should get rid of it altogether. No more alcohol.
Texas, we had, like everybody else, I think for ages, 21 was the age, 5, 6 years ago? They lowered it to 19 with that, what I feel is a very rational argument. If somebody's old enough to fight and vote and so forth and so on, they're old enough to drink. Well, what has happened is that the alcohol-related deaths among that age group have just skyrocketed. We had 4 deaths in the city of San Marcos, a city of about 25,000, in the first 3 months of this year, and they were all 4 students.
Car accidents?
Automobile accidents, yes, I meant to say that. That did more than anything else to arouse our students, especially since they were all females. The girls and the sororities have really gotten interested in the subject. It's sad that it takes that to happen. But the next thing that's happening is now there is a big move in the state to raise the age back. Well, I'm going to stop it here and go on to the next subject. I'm just trying to kind of rile y'all up, give you something to talk about the rest of the evening. I don't know that there are any answers to this, so that either one of these, but let's kind of fill in time here. Let's go on to sex. I'd like to read you a couple of quotes. First of all, a quote from a little book, How to Talk to God When You Aren't Feeling Religious, by Charles Merrill Smith. If I am ever on a TV talk show and the host asks me, why do you believe in God? I will answer with just one word. I'll say sex. If in this imaginary dialogue he presses me to amplify this answer, I'll say something like this. There are many indications of God's existence, but for me, nothing nails it down half so well as a superb sex experience. I might be persuaded that this collection of atoms called Earth accidentally came together as a result of a cosmic bang. I could even imagine that the stars in their course were hurled into position by a mindless force. But when I am locked to the body of the woman I love, when we are melded in tenderness, passion, and joy, I can't believe this amazing creation came about except by the hand of an intelligent, wise, compassionate creator. Nothing that is so much fun as sex could have been an unplanned accident of natural forces. No way. And a second quote by one of my favorite authors, Robert Capon, from his little book, Bed and Board. Capon says, "I believe intercourse is important, even big, even one of the central things, but I can't manage to take it quite that seriously. I have a sneaking suspicion that all this straight-faced piety about sexuality misses one of the Creator's most brilliant bits of humor. The body uses the same general equipment for both love-making and plumbing. Desire and drainage are hilariously close." Capon ends by saying, "I think that's a hint to take it lightly." And finally, some more random thoughts from yours truly. "The thing that takes up the least amount of time and causes the most amount of trouble is sex." So observed John Barrymore, the famous actor of a generation past, and that's been true for me in my own personal life. Learning to deal with my own sexuality has been a long, continuous struggle. As one raised in an era when sin and sex were almost synonymous, I've had a tough time coming to a point where I can accept the fact that my sexuality is a gift from God. That sex can be a positive, good, okay part of my life. On the other hand, I've had to realize that there is a dark side to my sexuality, a side that without discipline can get out of control and lead me into dangerous waters. If I'm not careful, sex can be a negative, evil, not okay part of my life. And I've also found Barrymore's observation to be true in my professional life. Over the years, a very high proportion of the people who have come to me for, quote, pastoral counseling have had problems of a sexual nature. They ask such questions as, "How do I relate to persons of the opposite sex? What's right? What's wrong? To bed or not to bed?" That is the question. People are wrestling with the problem of sex, and many of them look to the church for guidance. And it seems to me that the church has two things to say to such people, especially those struggling with the question of premarital intercourse. First of all, to people struggling with the problem before the fact, the church has the responsibility of speaking a word of warning. The Bible speaks clearly on this matter: "Thou shalt not commit adultery." Fornicators are also on this list of Paul's, of those who shall not inherit the kingdom of heaven. And these strong words are spoken, I think, to warn us of the dangers inherent in the misuse of God's gift of sex. Even in our modern age, with all of its advances in the area of birth control, people still find themselves unexpectedly expecting. In spite of all the progress in disease prevention, VD is rampant. And even when these physical dangers are avoided, there can still be emotional consequences. People still have consciences. Guilt is not dead. It's alive and feeding on the guts of many a, quote, sexual sinner. Now, such things as this may be very entertaining in soap operas, but they aren't when they happen to you in real life. They can be exceedingly painful and destructive. A good God and a caring church do not want people to suffer such consequences. Therefore, the church and God speak out loudly: be careful. Don't do something that's going to hurt you. But people don't always listen to warnings. What then does the church say to people after the fact? to people who have bedded but aren't wedded and now regret it? Well, I think that the church speaks words of care and comfort and forgiveness. Here, too, the Bible speaks clearly. As much as Jesus was against adultery, he saved the woman taken in adultery from stoning. His friends were prostitutes. And he spoke kindly to the woman at the well who was living with a man out of wedlock. To me, the message is clear. Sexual sins are not unforgivable sins. Slip in this area and you've still got a second chance. There is still room for you in the kingdom. There is still room for you in the church. And it is in the church where you can find understanding and comfort to help you get over the consequences of your indiscretions, as well as strength to help you avoid the same mistake again. A good God and a caring church do not want people to suffer the consequences of their sins alone. Therefore, they speak out loudly, "We care. We really care about you. Let us help you in your hurt." So as you struggle with your sexuality, may you hear both of these words of the church, the words of warning and the words of comfort. I should explain that all these quotes come out of a little newsletter that I do for students, so if they sound like they're aimed at students, they are. Okay, some thoughts on sex. Look, we're wasting all this tape.
I'd like to know where can our young people in the church body get an opportunity, a place to talk about some of the frustrations that they have as they become aware of their sexuality, how to cope, peer pressure. Where would you suggest is a good place? Is it confirmation? Is it before confirmation? Youth groups? What have you found from other kids that where they say, hey, this is... And also, I'd like to ask the college students here in high school and in junior high students, have you ever talked about this subject, peer pressure and sex and alcohol, in your church? And in what context?
You asked a bunch of people and a bunch of questions. My experience that we still, no matter how enlightened we say we are about sex, that most of the students that I've dealt with over the years and still do deal with, their parents have said nothing to them about it, or very little. Their church has said very little or nothing to them about it. Their schools have said very little or nothing about it. I know there are exceptions to that rule, but I'm afraid that, at least from my observation, that's still the generality, and that scares me. I think that's part of the problem. Yes?
Well, I go to a private school in Cameroon, and we had a 3-month session on that, and so it was really helpful. There were only 3 of us in it, but... Well, there's only 11 kids in school anyway, but...
This was what, just a sex education class, or did they call it that?
We talked about a lot of things, depending on what session it was on.
Okay.
So, not always.
Ron?
Yes?
I just came from a camp where we had junior and senior high kids, and we used a study in Ephesians 6, you know, get me on this, on where it's found. We talked about the sword of the Spirit, we talked the helmet of salvation, all of that stuff. We talked the helmet of salvation, we talked about movies, books, things that can ruin your mind so that the mindset isn't on Christ. And then we used about, we talked about sex. And that was the first time I've ever heard of a pastor talking to junior high and senior high kids on that. And they were just into it. They had all these questions that night. They didn't get to bed till 4 in the morning because they just had questions constantly. And it was never tackled within the home. and it wasn't, and they were just having super problems. This was up in Alaska in a small village, but there was still the peer pressure and all this stuff. But it was a good way to introduce it, and that's how we did it.
I think we have to start early. I teach seventh grade, and just on bodily functions, we separated the girls and the boys, and you know, one of the male nurses took the fellas, and a female nurse had the girls just for bodily function changes. And yet there were many questions that came out. So you can't say, well, they're too young. Kids that are 12 and 13 are definitely experiencing their sexuality, and if you don't give them some information that is correct, they'll find it someplace else. So I think we many times, you know, bury our heads and think, well, if we just don't talk about it, you know, it'll go away.
Well, in our school district, it started in fifth and sixth grade. And in fifth grade, they had just a very kind of skimmy on the surface. In sixth grade, they have to have parental permission. Well, first of all, there's a preview for the parents, so they can see what it is. And then if they said, oh, I want my kid to have this, and I can sign a thing, and their child doesn't participate. But the boys, again, are separated from the girls during this program. That's really good. Well, if you just look at the sixth grade kids, how mature some of them are, that you know that you better start early with educating them.
Yes?
They do start really early, but most of the time in the sex ed classes and health classes that I've been in, the teacher won't answer questions or even give you the opportunity to ask. They'll say, oh, well, read chapter 16, adult is worksheet, and they'll hand something out to you, and you really won't learn anything that you haven't learned before. You know, it just, you go over and over the same things, and you never get a chance to ask questions or find out what you really want to know.
The question, I think, here, I mean, you know, we're getting off on sex education from a purely physical and that kind of thing. I think it's very, very important, just like alcohol education. You know, what does alcohol do? But what about, it seems to me as if we're wrestling with a, quote, moral question, a religious question here. Where are you getting educated in sexual morality? Those of you who are that age, or I didn't hear that. TV?
TV.
Let's go in the back.
Well, I'm involved with junior high age kids at our church, and we belong to a very large congregation, and did not realize that most of our children do not even know what the word fornication means. I taught a Sunday school class to seventh graders on fornication. That week before, I thought, oh Lord, you know, how am I going to do this? You know, what am I going to tell these seventh grade girls? That was one of the neatest classes I've ever had. But those children did not even know what that word meant.
We don't hear that very much.
No. And we need to educate our children. And of course, I think number one, too, it comes from the home. But we're dealing with so many children from, you know, homes that maybe we only have a mom, or maybe we only have a dad. You know, this kind of a thing. But I think we that have contact with these children through our churches and that kind of thing, and we're putting into the position that we need to tell our children what's right and what's wrong. And I think so many times we're afraid to do that.
Nasty question. What is right and what is wrong? Is it that simple sometimes to say what is right? But we got another hand back here.
That TV, we take it lightly, but I think it's one of the most dangerous instruments. I enjoy TV, but when I see them taking smut lightly and making a joke out of it, and we see our young people, statistic-wise, how many hours they're spending in front of TV sets, and some of the programs that they're putting on and making a joke out of it. I think the real education is slipping into our society is coming out of TV, and we should be wise to it. Try and get her under control.
Yes, sir.
It seems to me that the key to the thing is something you mentioned before but did not pursue, and that is the definition of adultery. Because from all it says in the Bible about it, the key to it is saying that you shall not commit adultery, and yet it's never really defined what is adultery. For instance, if if you have two people living together who have not, by a judge or a pastor or something like that, been married officially in your society, is that adultery? How do you deal with that as far as people in the church, people, church members? If you have church members that just live together and they're not even planning on getting married, they're just trying it out for 8 or 10 years. And most of them maybe last 2 or 3. But how do we deal with that in the church? Do we say as a congregation, well, we can't have anything to do with you because you're committing adultery? We never seem to really have defined adultery. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, my only thought on that is that I found that most of the people that I know of, and these are college-age students who are living in that kind of situation, are not involved in the church. And they are not involved in the church because they have heard loud and clear from the church that the church condemns what they are doing, and they have heard nothing about the compassion and care that the church has for them as individuals, even though they are, quote, living in sin. And that kind of bothers me, too. Have to speak that word of judgment, and we have to speak that word of warning, but we also have to somehow, I've used this term over and over here in some of my other presentations, get out that image that the church is not just the communion of saints, it's the communion of sinners, too. It's not a hospital for saints, or a museum for saints, it's a hospital for sinners. And that every one of us in the church is a sinner. Dadgummit. We're on that list in one form or fashion. And these people who are alcoholics, or these people who are in adultery or something, they need the church. Jesus came to the outcast. I did a thing on that the other day. But anyway, we have not, too many people are only hearing the judgment of the church. And when they get in a situation like this because of whatever weakness or whatever, I see so many of them saying, you know, I cannot go back to the church because the church, all it will do is send me to hell and make me feel worse and guilty. They will not care for me.
But are they really living in sin, as you say?
My working definition of sin, and I can't defend this theologically. I think I maybe could, but I can't. That didn't make any sense. But my working definition of sin is anything that hurts people. Anything that hurts people. I don't like to get hurt. I don't like people that I love and care about to get hurt. I try to do everything in my power to keep them from getting hurt. And I think a sin is where people get hurt. And God doesn't want people to get hurt either. That's why he is so against sin. He didn't sit up there and say, okay, these things, are sins, just arbitrarily, and if you do them, then I'm going to, you know, kick you out of my kingdom and so forth. No, they're very good reasons for why certain things are, quote, sins, because they have hurtful consequences. And all of these, alcohol and the misuse of sex, brings with it a hurt, or at least has that possibility. You know, there are a lot of people who say, hey, it's great, it's good. And I don't want to get arguing with them about that either, but there's a lot, and I mentioned some of those, of hurtful consequences. And that is, you know, I can't give you a whole biblical history, but adultery, you know, the people of Israel was a tribal society. They were built on the family, and anything that fouled up the family just hurt the society and everything else. So that's why they took such a firm stand against adultery, breaking up the family. But at the same time, you try to find a good definition of what is marriage. When does a marriage take place in the Bible? And you know, you got all kinds of good biblical saints with a whole slew of wives and concubines and so forth. There are a lot of rascals among our list of saints. It's a pretty cultural kind of thing, is kind of my impression of what is a, quote, sexual sin. And it varies greatly, greatly from culture to culture, even in our world today. That what is a sexual sin in America may be not in Sweden or Cameroon or somewhere else. How are you getting in there? Save me.
No.
I just want to make a comment. It's not just geared to a college student, but just to all of us, because I have a difficult time simply focusing on that, because the issues here certainly involve the rest of us, you know, whether we're in school or not. And I think one of the issues, as I see, that we as a church need to wrestle with is in terms of the whole issue of abstinence in our society. How much we're willing to face that issue. For me, at least, there are people within the kingdom that need to face the issue of abstinence as far as alcohol is concerned, because they cannot handle alcohol. And you can't make a law about that, but at least I think one of the difficulties within some of our mainline churches, the Lutheran Church, is that we have not opened up that road or let people really wrestle with that possibility enough. I realize that our heritage is, you know, at least for some of us, the condemning of alcoholics. I guess my own background, being raised in an alcoholic situation where it was never condemned, I saw the other side of it, where of all the abuse that was going on and how families were hurt, and so I was burned from a different point of view, you know. And so when I speak of the possibilities of abstinence, I'm coming from the point of view of how much time do we have in our society to make a contribution? Some of us have very little. And if we're going to make any kind of contribution in our life, at least some of us, I think, need to consider whether we can do all these things and still make any kind of contribution for the kingdom and for our children and for, you know, I raise it up simply as a possibility for at least some of us who are very weak. I can't speak to all people, but I know that some of us who are very weak can't afford to spend a lot of our time wrestling with the problem of alcoholism. Some of us who are very weak, I don't think, can afford to transgress as far as our marriage is concerned, because when we have lost our marriage, we have lost a lot of our effectiveness, perhaps in doing what we wanted to accomplish in life. I feel that just as some possibilities here.
Well, I kind of hear you saying that you have to know yourself and what your limitations are and what, you know, one person can, you know. I have a bunch of people that I, quote, drink with in a social setting, and they're all happy people, and, you know, it's really no problem. But I have one very close friend, he gets about 3 beers under, and he's one of these violent drunks. That guy should not drink. But he's big muscle, and I haven't had the guts to tell him. you know, and that's a self-awareness thing I think we have to go through. Yes?
That brings another topic up in my mind, is how much responsibility do we have with our Christian brothers and sisters to continue to drink in front of them when they have a problem?
That's a good point. Very good point. At the same time, we've had the rather interesting issue on our campus this last semester of some people wanting to have a tavern on campus, which is on lots of campuses now, state colleges. And one of the arguments was that it would be a model of how to use alcohol properly. Well, now I happen to believe, I think there's a good point there. I think that we should somehow tell people, hey, you can. Alcohol is a gift and it can be used properly. I happen not to think that a tavern on campus will do that, but I think that's a good point there, that just as we shouldn't be, we should watch our drinking in front of somebody who abuse that. At the same time, we have a responsibility, those of us who like to drink and don't have a problem with it, we have a responsibility to show that side of it too. And that really gets ticklish, doesn't it? How do we get off on alcohol and not sex?
Yeah.
I'll only entertain a sex question. Oh, Doris Edmonds.
Okay, are you ready for this?
I doubt it, but I'll
Well, down California way, it's very popular for senior citizens who are widowed or
and left alone to find another partner and without benefit of marriage live together. What do you think of that? That's my question.
I just work with college students. Well, I think the point is well made that it's not just a college or a young person's problem. It's across the board. And sex is a fact of life. And there's that good part of sex. We all need that. And we need to honestly face up to that is a natural need. It is a gift of God. Now, traditionally, we have expressed that need in the marriage context. But now, is that still the way to do it? You know, used to, I assume you've heard this, but it's up until just very recently, that when you married somebody and said, until death do us part, that was usually about a 15-year contract because of the life expectancy. Now, if you get married at 20 and the average life expectancy is what, 74 or something like that? That's a long time. Now we can laugh at that, but you know, that's a whole different, it really is a different ballgame.
Why is that?
Huh?
The longer the better.
That's right.
Then it gets better as you get older.
Okay. Well, I guess all I'm saying is...
Really, I was 60 yesterday, the day before yesterday, and I can vouch for that. Marriage and the sex.
I guess that's not what I'm... the point I'm raising, but I guess what I'm saying is, can two people, you know, two people can maybe live together 15 years pretty easily with a minimum amount of problems. But when you start with 54... You know, you just magnify the possibilities of problems and temptations and all that.
I think it's the other way around. It's harder in the beginning.
I've been married 27 years.
And you can see that.
What's that? I have a granddaughter 6 years old. I have two children. So I know what I'm talking about. I have a daughter who's been divorced and remarried. You know, I don't speak with this out of an ivory tower, folks.
Well, keep going. You're about halfway there.
Or what?
54.
Well, I got somebody here. You haven't said anything.
Well, my daughter, when she was in high school, our school district has a system whereby they contract with the local health department to have a nurse come in and do sex ed. In the grade schools, 5th and 6th grade, they do them with the kids separate, and I think partway through junior high they do. It's strictly biological sex ed, and there's nothing left out after they get into junior high. When they get into high school, they still get this annually. The nurse comes, and she brings all of the various kinds of birth control, explains them, passes them through the mixed classes, and the kids get to the point that they're just totally bored with the whole thing. They ridicule it, they handle it in all kinds of different ways. They do it in a way that is, according to the supervisor of the district health department that is primarily responsible for getting someone to go up there and do it. She says, we don't discuss ethics. Well, you know, you can't, I don't think that you can handle sex ed without, you either are moral or amoral. It cannot be one, it cannot be, you know, in a neutral ground. And our pregnancy rate is soaring, our BB rate is soaring. This has not helped the kids from strictly a physical situation. Relationships are never discussed. And I think that it's up to the church in some way, either by helping the parents understand better about sexuality and about relationships so the parents can teach them, or by maybe the church doing something so that it's not taken out of the context of relationships. This can be done. An excellent source is James Dobson's Preparing for Adolescence. He has a cassette series. And I think the churches would do well to make that available to people for doing this.
if I were to sum it up, my working attitude, I guess, in both of these areas is to try to speak to people in a loving, compassionate way. I think that's the real key to how we say anything, is that we express our care and that we give them the word of warning about alcoholism and sexuality, but at the same time, we give them the word of care and compassion.